Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly guide to all that's hot and happening in the technology world. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we'll be discussing the taking down of the world's biggest online criminal marketplace. We'll also find out about the latest tech investment craze, where you're invited to back projects from space exploration to an online lottery with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And we hear about the rise of the online gig economy. With me is the BBC technology reporter, Chris Fox. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Rory.
Good to see you again. And my special guest is Alison Van Diggelen, who often reports for us from Silicon Valley, but she's here in the studio this time. Welcome, Alison.
Great to join you, Rory.
Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
A lot of the sort of text that you see online in blogs, in product descriptions and so on. Actually, a lot of that, interestingly, is written in these English-speaking African countries.
The astronauts will have to take the pictures at the defined angles and float around the camera to complete the set of images.
All of that in a moment. But first this week, what's being hailed by law enforcement officers in the United States and Europe as a stunning victory in the battle against cyber criminals. Two huge online criminal marketplaces, Alphabet and Hansa, have been taken down in an international police operation, which seems to show that the dark web isn't quite as hidden from investigators as some of its users might think. Chris Fox, tell us more about how this story unfolded.
So Alphabet and Hansa were well known on the dark web. That's the layer of the internet that's not going to pop up on your regular search engine if you're looking for it. If you wanted something illegal, those sites had you covered. On Alphabet, there were thousands of listings for chemicals and drugs, including heroin, and it was big business too. $450 million spent on Alphabet between May 2015 and February 2017. Now, Hansa was seized by police in June, but they kept it running to monitor what was going on, who was using it, and also where people were going beyond Hansa. And police say the closure of the two sites has given them a lot of leads. So Will van Gemert is the deputy director of Europol. He told the BBC what impact the closures would have.
For sure, it has destabilized the market, not only by not having the marketplace at this moment and to have to find an alternative, but especially from the trust point of view. So those markets until that moment were seen as safe and not being viewed by the police. And I think what the international cooperation led to was the understanding that this is not a safe place to be. You should not buy drugs or something else in the dark market.
So, Chris, the police, pretty triumphant, pretty sophisticated operation. They got right into the people who were actually administrating it, who thought that they were anonymous. Is this the final victory against this, or will they just simply come back in another form?
I think things like this are always a game of cat and mouse, and when one site is closed down, another one may pop up in its place. But police say they have got a lot of leads now. They kind of know where people are buying drugs, even on other sites, because once one site closed down, people popped up on message boards saying, let's try this other one instead. So it's given them a lot of information.
Yeah, I loved some of the detail in the indictment that the FBI published. There's a great line about Alphabet having a public relations officer whose job was to reach out to the wider darknet community. These are pretty sophisticated operations, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But even there's a suggestion that in some of the code it gave away who was behind it. So little mistakes like that have given away the people that made it.
Alison Van Diggelen, quick word from you on this. Important step, really, in the battle against cybercrime.
It is an important step, but I think it's just a blip in the big picture because, as Chris says, it's a game of cat and mouse, and the nefarious users are just going to pop up elsewhere. So I think they can celebrate, but no, I think the celebrations won't last long.
Did you say to me earlier it's like a waterbed effect? Was that you said that you push down on one area and then it will pop up somewhere else?
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, we were covering the Silk Road, the demise of the Silk Road a few years back, and it came back bigger and more effective in the form of Alphabet. Look out for the next one. I'm sure the police will be doing that. Now, it feels all of a sudden like 1999, with investors getting very excited about the potential of new technology. Back then, it was the dot-com bubble as shares in anything related to the internet soared. This time, the latest investment craze centres around cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and the blockchain technology which underpins them. This year has seen huge surges in the value of Bitcoin and another cryptocurrency, Ethereum. And we've also seen investors put more than $1 billion into what are called ICOs, initial coin offerings, where new currencies are launched. Now, this is a pretty complex area. We've been trying to get our head around it. Let's get Chris Fox to define a couple of the terms. So, Chris, first of all, explain to us what a cryptocurrency is.
Well, a cryptocurrency is a system of money where instead of paying people with coins or banknotes, you use a digital asset instead, such as a specially generated computer file. So it's a virtual currency, and the crypto part comes in because you can use cryptography or complicated mathematics to regulate the creation of the currency, verify transactions to help prevent fraud, and in theory the system can look after itself with no need for a central banker. People always say, why do people think this has got any value? Why do crypto coins have any value? But as long as people are willing to assign them value and accept them as payment, then they have value just the same as any other currency.
And what is an initial coin offering, an ICO?
Well, that's a bit like a crowdfunding campaign. You can offer early tokens or early coins from these currencies to investors who want to get their hands on them. They might invest in those, hoping that it will become worth a lot more in the future. And the tokens can also give you a stake in the business.
Thanks. Now, in a moment, we're going to talk to Pavlo Tanashuk, who's planning to use this technique to fund a space exploration business called Spacebit. But also in the studio, we're going to get a sceptical view from the finance blogger, Francis Coppola. Francis, this week you wrote a very interesting blog in which you compared the crypto craze to the Dutch tulip fever of the 17th century. Why?
I'm quite cruel, aren't I, really? Well, if you think about it, if you're an investor buying into some new technology, new craze, new idea, the latest thing, the latest fashion, right? It doesn't really matter whether you are buying shares, whether you're buying bonds, whether you're buying coins, crypto somethings, or tulip bulbs. They are still just things. And there's a considerable Ponzi element about this, whereby you buy it because you think it's going to rise in value. And it has nothing to do with the fundamental value of the ability of this thing to flower or whatever it does. It's got everything to do with just the whole market, everybody piling in saying, hey, you've got to get into this, you can't lose. Now, such markets eventually reach a top, and then they crash. And at that point, there's a huge shakeout. Lots of people lose lots of money. The things may or may not become worthless. Some of them will. I think in this case, there will be some that won't. The problem is trying to identify which have real value.
And which are investors clear in these ICOs where they're getting a vague promise of some, not even a definite stake in a business?
No.
It seems pretty vague what they're buying.
It's pretty vague. A lot of them are not getting any kind of stake in the business. At least with a share, you get part of the business. With this, you don't. It is simply a token, a coin. That's all.
Well, let's hear the other side. Pavlo Tanashuk, you've got a very interesting idea. It's called Spacebit. You're going to use an ICO or a fundraising exercise using cryptocurrencies to realise this vision. First of all, what is the vision?
Well, in the past, space project used to be funded by governments. Then we have companies like SpaceX. I strongly believe the future of space exploration is crowdfunding, and our company is the first decentralized company which will be built using crowdfunding model.
So what will people actually be buying if they send you money in whatever form?
Well, they will be buying tokens from our business, as well as they will be able
to... Tokens? What yes. use is to me as a token from your business?
Yes. Well, it will have a specific use case, which is quite complex, and I wouldn't be able to elaborate on it right now. But this token would be a representation of value, of future values that our business would generate.
And they would be also involved in steering your businesses up.
Absolutely. That's an interesting part. So actually, we want them to be actively involved in our business, making decisions, maybe not on a daily basis, but some major decisions should be made by public. That's my belief.
And it's because you've got this belief in the blockchain technology, which underpins virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies, that you're using this method. Explain that.
Absolutely. Well, I believe that our reality is socially constructed anyway, but blockchain is very important because it's not only gives us opportunity to raise money, but also to build a complex economic models behind a company. So you can actually build something which is not simply a money-raising mechanism, but actually people can vote, people can do things, and you can redistribute profits in a new way.
Now, listen, if you had a realistic vision for a space business, like Elon Musk's SpaceX, you would go surely to venture capitalists or bankers or even standard crowdfunding to raise the money for that. That would be a more regulated way of doing it, instead of which you're going down what to a lot of people will seem an incredibly risky route.
Well, no one believed Elon Musk back in the day. So actually, I believe that now
he did raise some money, though.
He did actually, yes. But he also put his own money, and that's something that I did in the beginning as well. But I believe that cryptocurrency itself, a cryptocurrency crowd, is a highly sort of phantasmagoric kind of crowd. That, and for them, investing in space, it's something that really rings the bell. And I believe that from my talks with them, they believe that it's something that should be doing. Because there are so many projects, as been said before, which are just basically new crypto tokens, and they don't really change the way we live our lives. And I believe we should create this vision that would take us to a new level as a humanity. That's very important.
I said at the beginning it felt like 1999 where we had this dot-com bubble. Isn't this another bubble?
Well, I believe we're not just there yet. I believe that very soon we will see big boys joining, like big companies trying to use ICOs as a way to crowdfund money. And I would say that would be a dangerous path because they would just jeopardize the systems. It would just cannibalize the current economic system behind. And the reason for that is because big companies that don't really want to disrupt. They want to innovate incremental changes, but not disruption. We want to disrupt with this technology.
Francis Coppola, briefly, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I agree, actually, that we're not actually at the top yet, and we are going to see bigger players coming in yet, and that tends to pump it up even more. The more come in, the bigger the eventual crash will be. But this is actually part of how technology, how new ideas eventually become kind of established in mainstream, is we have a huge period of enthusiasm like this when everybody piles in. Then there's a crash, we have a huge shakeout, lots of things die, lots of people lose money. And what emerges from that are the future value generators. So it's actually a really exciting time.
So a sceptic, but also an optimistic sceptic. Francis, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, the global boom in online work you can do from home. But first, let's take a look at a couple of the week's other big tech stories with Chris Fox and Alison van Diggelen. Chris, big problems with a mobile phone when calling the emergency services. Which phone was this?
Yeah, so this was the OnePlus 5. OnePlus is a phone manufacturer that makes high-end phones at low prices, and they've admitted a glitch in some of the phones prevented people from calling the emergency services. Some customers on Reddit pointed out that if you tried to dial 911, the phone rebooted, and they were pretty angry about it because it could endanger lives. Others noted the same happened here in the UK if you try to dial 999 and 112 in Europe. The company said it's developed a software fix for the issue, and everyone with a OnePlus phone should install it. But there's been no apology, though.
Alison, Elon Musk's audacious plan to whiz people through tubes, and this is not about SpaceX, this is his plan, his Hyperloop plan. It's had a big boost this week, or has it?
Well, it depends whether your glass is half full or empty or major skeptic. So Elon Musk this week announced on Twitter that he'd received verbal government approval to build a Hyperloop between New York and DC and to connect the city in under 30 minutes.
So that's a route that people fly and takes quite a long time.
Yes, high population area, a lot of traffic.
And you got verbal assurance. What is verbal assurance?
Well, this is the big question. He hasn't really released any more information about it, but he has urged, one of his tweets urged people to get active. He said, if you want this to happen fast, let your state and national representatives know. And he's basically encouraging citizen activism to get this going. And if listeners don't know what a Hyperloop is, it's an underground bullet train capable of speeds up to 600 miles an hour. So if you imagine a sleek train carriage propelled on air like a puck in an air hockey table.
I wonder if you'll launch an initial coin offering to fund that. And Chris, which robot met an untimely end this week?
This is the sad story of a security robot in Washington, D.C. that drowned after falling into a fountain. If you haven't seen these pictures online, get on the BBC.
It went quite viral, didn't it?
They're very, very funny in their misery. Nightscope, it's called. It's like a tall white cone with a camera for an eye. It's supposed to roll around buildings autonomously, keeping an eye on things. But this one went off its regular route in a building and went into a decorative fountain where it drowned. And photos of it laid down in the water. It does look very miserable. They're on our website. And the company said it's going to replace the robot.
I noticed that some of the office workers had built a little shrine to it, a memorial shrine to it. Very, very sad story. Moving on. We've heard a lot in recent years about the so-called gig economy, where people carry out short-term tasks or gigs as drivers for companies like Uber or dispatch riders for food delivery firms like Deliveroo. But another trend is emerging, where companies outsource tasks to workers around the world who can do them without leaving home. A study by the Oxford Internet Institute found this online gig economy had grown by more than a quarter over the past year. The report's author, Willy Leidenwerter, told me more.
First of all, in terms of the types of work, we can see that software development and technology contracting is the biggest category of work, followed by creative and multimedia work, remote marketing work, and so on. All the way down to sort of professional services like accounting, even some legal advice. And then in terms of the geography of the phenomena, on the one hand, what you see is that people in wealthy Western countries with high labor costs are buying work from countries with lower labor costs like India and Philippines. But then in addition to that, you see a pattern where clients, employers all over the world are buying skills, talents that are not available in their local market. So, for example, we can see that UK-based freelancers are providing a lot of this sort of professional services work to the market.
I looked at one of these platforms and you can actually get work done incredibly cheaply. $50 I saw quoted for an iPhone app, developing an iPhone app. That could really have quite an impact on well-paid developers in, say, the United States and poorly paid developers in India.
That's right. So we see from our data that the South Asian countries command about a 55% market share in software development technology freelancing in the online labor market. And so it's having a big impact there in terms of providing income for people in low-income countries. But of course, it's also then helping to push down the price of that kind of work in higher-income countries, which is great for clients, but maybe not that great for people who have been earning their income that way. Now, of course, one of the things that we're seeing how people are responding is what economics would suggest is that in different countries, people are specializing on different types of work and serving different customer segments.
And you also saw people that you might not expect to be getting into this online economy, people in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, so that's quite interesting because, of course, outsourcing, this sort of outsourcing of work to India and Philippines, that has been happening for 20, 30 years already. But it's only benefited those people who live in countries where these multinational outsourcing companies set up and start hiring people. But of course, what the internet has been expected to enable for a long time is that anywhere, anyone from, you know, the middle of desert could connect to clients and start working. And that hasn't really happened before, but this data shows that now in some internet-savvy countries in sub-Saharan Africa, especially Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa, are participating in the market. And they're especially active in writing work. So a lot of the sort of text that you see online in blogs, in product descriptions, and so on, actually a lot of that, interestingly, is written in these English-speaking African countries.
Philly Leidenwerter. Francis Coppola, we were talking about the cryptocurrencies and how that was changing the world. Another technology that's supposed to change the world was the internet was going to transform the world of work it's happening actually quite slowly. That phenomenon, the online working online, has been quite slow to arrive, really, hasn't it?
Yes, and I'm a little bit sceptical about it, because it's all very well saying, oh, we can have all this online stuff. But in the end, you know, commerce really is about moving real things around, like goods. It's like Amazon with its drone deliveries and things like that. Now, at the end of the line, there always has to be that connection with something real.
You say that we live in a sort of weightless world. We've got software. We're seeing software can be written anywhere. You don't have to go into an office to write software. You don't have to go into an office to write
software. I mean, you know, companies like delivering food.
Alison van Diggelen, you live in California, the birthplace of this idea. Is still a lot of enthusiasm around it?
I'd say in pockets. It was really interesting. There's a recent Pew study that estimated that nearly a quarter of all Americans are earning some money through these platforms, but the average wage was incredibly low. The majority of gig workers, you know, for Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, DoorDash, less than $500 a month. So it's really not a living wage. It really has to be a side gig. So, that was quite revealing, I thought. It's really precarious employment. You know, tech can empower, but it can also enslave.
Yeah, and it's what we heard there was some people willing to do jobs for a lot less around the world. You know, I saw an iPhone app being developed for $50. You know, you wouldn't pay you would expect to pay a lot more than $50 in California to get an iPhone app developed.
Absolutely, yes, yeah.
It is beginning to have a downward impact on wages. Now, before we go, something really fun happened this week. Google took its Street View service into space. You can now tour the International Space Station from Google Street View. Alice Liu from the company told us how the imagery aboard the ISS was gathered.
To stitch panoramic images, we take a camera and mount it on a fixed mount and rotate the camera around to collect views of different angles and stitch them into a panorama. And in space, there's really no tripod. And we ended up using a pair of bungee cords that are strapped in the module in a crisscross fashion so that the crossing point defines the center of where the camera needs to be. And the astronauts will have to take the pictures at the defined angles and float around the camera to complete the set of images.
That's Google's Alice Liu. And you can read more of that interview by my colleague Leo Kellyan at bbc.com/technology. Pavlo Tanishuk, our guest, who was talking about his Spacebit Foundation earlier, you're sitting here in our studio. You've got a fantastic jacket on, which looks like a sort of astronaut's jacket. Briefly, huge enthusiasm generally about space and any technology around space.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, our project also talking about artificial intelligence that we will be using on our space mission. So it's not only actually funding this space project, but also technologies around space exploration as well. That's very important for future missions.
And you're convinced that people will be investing in that. We'll keep an eye on that in future. We're running out of time. Thanks very much to my special guest, Alison van Diggelen, and to Chris Fox from the BBC Technology Desk. Don't forget, you can read all our stories at bbc.com/technology. Also, go to our Facebook page, Facebook Technology and Tech Tent, and join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.